You're listening to the Sexual Wellness Sessions with Kate Moyle. Today's episode was brought to you by Blueheart, the easy-to-use, expert-designed app for couples who are experiencing difficulties with libido, one of the most common sexual challenges that couples come up against. Blueheart are challenging the taboo around the subject by making getting help and advice more accessible. Blueheart's removing some of the barriers to make sex therapy possible for everyone. They offer expert-led therapeutic techniques, activities, education, and guided conversations, all from the app so that you can prioritize your relationship and sexual well-being in a way that works for you at your own pace. The Blueheart app is available to download now on Android and iPhone. Today's episode is on the theme of relationships, which, whilst it's woven into all of the conversations in this podcast, is something that I wanted to have a focused discussion about. I'll be having this conversation with author of 20 books, including the international bestsellers I Love You, But I'm Not in Love with You, and How Can I Ever Trust You Again, Andrew G. Marshall. Andrew is a marital therapist who trained 35 years ago with Relate and leads a team of relationship and psychosexual therapists in private practice in the UK. He also hosts his own podcast, The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. And I guess, Andrew, you are, you know, a huge relationship expert, a massive author of, 20 books. I've got many of them on my bookshelf, and a lot of them were some of the first books that I started reading when I was exploring going into this field. But I guess the big question that so many people are going to have is, what are the key factors of relationship well-being? You know, how do we make relationships work, and how do we make relationships last?
Well, I think it's actually the same for keeping your sex life alive and keeping your relationship alive. So let me talk about keeping the sex alive, and then I'll transpose that into the whole relationship. The problem is, I think, for a lot of people, it's down to their beliefs. Now, if your belief when it comes to sex, and this is something I struggle against, that sex should be spontaneous, we should both feel turned on at exactly the same time, and that will give us the most wonderful sex. And, you know, spontaneous sex is wonderful, but you'll probably only both feel spontaneously sexual about three times a year, probably on Valentine's Day, once on holiday, and, you know, once when the moon and the stars are all in the right alignment, which is not really the basis for a great relationship. But there are some people who are prepared to plan sex. I really do not understand what is so wrong with planning, but that lots of people struggle with this idea. You need to prioritize it, because unless you leave enough time for it, it's always going to be at the bottom of a to-do list, and you're going to be two tired people at the end of the day coming with the least amount of energy. It's not going to be very great. And the third thing is, you have to take self-responsibility for your sexuality. It's not a case of expecting your beloved partner to turn you on. Sort of, you know, here I am, turn me on. Mm. And in a sense, it's the same with relationships in general. If you believe in some kind of magic that they will just sort of happen, then I think you're going to be disappointed. But if you're prepared to prioritize your relationship, put boundaries around it, and take responsibility for your own stuff, rather than expecting your partner to sort it out. You know, I had a miserable childhood and somehow you've got to make up for it. And although this might be happening consciously, can sometimes be happening unconsciously. So I think it's the two things are exactly the same. You know, you can sort of leave it to myths and magic, or you can actually learn the skills and put the energy into it.
Do you think that that is really common, that we put the responsibility on our partners rather than recognizing the responsibility in ourselves? Because I guess I often talk to people about how we have responsibility for what we put in or our role we play in stuff, but it's just so much easier to blame someone else, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I have lots of couples who come to me with a never-ending list of what their partner can do differently. And then when I say, yeah, I hear that these are all problems for you, but what could you do differently? The answer is normally blank silence, or, well, I could just bury them all. And there is actually a huge number of alternatives beyond it's all your fault or, you know, I'm giving up.
And something that I've heard, I really like, and I've heard talked about, is how the Gottman Institute talk about the four horsemen in terms of kind of effectively managing conflict. And they are contempt, criticism, defensiveness, and stonewalling. And
I think it's the recipes for a really good relationship, aren't they?
And I think it's just, they're really interesting points. And I think we can all recognize that sometimes we do those things, or they might be patterns that we employ, but they are largely unhelpful. But they talk about how we need to break away from those four things in order to move forward. And I wondered what you thought about that.
Oh, I couldn't agree more, that those are the real killers of relationships. But I just come back to my one central question, that actually, if people only take one thing away, please take this. What could I do differently? And we can always do something differently. I have a technique that I call the flop flip. So you know what doesn't work because you've been trying it over and over again. So, you know, you try, if your modus operandi is sulking, then, you know, the only thing you can think of is sulking bigger. And it's difficult to think of what else you can do, but this is where flop flip works. You do the complete opposite of what you do. So if you sulk, then you have to talk, you have to speak your truth. However unpleasant it's going to be for your partner, it's much better than a sulky silence. You know, if you rant and you pour it all out, then what's the opposite of that? It's probably listening. And if your partner isn't talking to you, asking questions, open questions like, what's the matter? What could I do differently? And, you know, if they rant back at you, then doing a little bit more listening. You know, I hear you're upset about X, Y, Z, but what thoughts have you got about how we could do it differently? These open questions. So take what you currently do, think what the opposite is. We know that the old things don't work. And, you know, often at the end of the time, really, when it comes down to it, at the end of counselling, when you look back, really, you only have to change one thing, but it's probably something really fundamental. And it's probably the opposite of what you're currently doing.
And it's that theory, isn't it, that we talk about in relationship therapy a lot, which is that couples have one argument hundreds of thousands of times.
Millions of times. And sometimes the argument actually isn't about anything, and you've got to dig down. I have a couple at the moment that I'm working with, and we discovered that the first argument was about a banana, the second one was about whether we should download the Disney Channel or not. Really, the argument isn't about either of those things. You have to dig down and actually understand, what is the argument really about? What are you frightened of? You know, and interestingly, this couple just had a complete and utter breakthrough because he opened up about his fears and she asked questions for a change. And it was just so beautiful. We broke out of, you know, that arguments about cabbages, and we actually got down to what this was really about. And, you know, once you get to that place, it's much easier to deal with it. You know, you're never going to solve an argument by winning the battle over the banana.
No, but it explains so much of why the small things, I mean, the bins and the dishwasher are always the examples that come up, aren't they? And that it, why those small things can bring about catastrophic disagreements.
So here's a nice question. If you're doing that, is what is this argument really about?
Mm.
Because it ain't about the bins.
Mm.
And I had a couple, and I spent 5 weeks with them, and they were arguing. I was just a witness on what should go into the freezer and what should come out of the freezer, and how to make certain there wasn't too much stuff in the freezer, and that the stuff wasn't in the freezer for too long before it went off. And I mean, I can't tell you how many variations on this freezer cycling system there was. And I knew that it wasn't about the freezer, but it took us a very long time to get past the freezer.
Mm.
But I'm a very patient man. If you want to argue for 5 weeks about the freezer, that's fine.
And I suppose it's about a battle of, is it unmet needs? Is that what we're talking about here? Is it feeling not listened to? Is it a complication of all of those things? And, you know, a lot of one of the theories that I love, and I just think it's so logical and sensible, is the five love languages. You know, we can see that it's so applicable in our lives. But there is so much in all of this, which is about understanding and misunderstanding each other. And that plays a huge part in sex as well.
Yes, and but I think that there's another layer underneath all of that, and that is fear. You know, we have a fundamental fear that somehow if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me, or I wouldn't be enough in some way. And the really weird thing is that when you actually let go of that fear and you show the real you, that brings the two of you closer. You know, when you actually show your vulnerability, you know, that is when the sexual attraction can really flow.
So ironic.
And you know, it takes a lot of bravery to do that. And you know, I think often my job is to sit with people and deal with their fears. And you know, when it comes to sex, the most important thing is being able to name our fears and talk about them. And you know, this is why I applaud your work so much, Kate, because you are talking about the stuff that we're frightened of talking about, and you're normalizing the fact that everybody has different desires, and that's okay. And if you know, you can actually be honest with yourself and your partner about your desires, you can probably find a way through that's going to work for both of you. But the fear is, if I show you what I like, you're going to run away from me, or you're going to shame me that I'm going to be, you know, unlovable. It's all down to fear. And something about sex is it brings fear right up to the surface.
It really does. It's so intrinsically linked with feelings of shame that expressing ourselves sexually is terrifying a lot of the time. And for a lot of people.
Well, it's the most intimate thing you can do, because you're bringing your body, you're bringing your personality. You are naked in every sense of the word.
Yeah. I often use the word exposed in every sense.
Yeah. This is, you know, this is who I am. And that is beautiful, but it's also terrifying.
And I love what you said there, that kind of irony of true intimacy coming with vulnerability, because that is, this for me, there are so many, and you know, as you know, you've been in the field a lot longer than I have, but there are so many contradictions in our beliefs about sex and relationships, and so many ironies and so many narratives that if we were able to work through them would free us up to be more genuinely ourselves and accept the perfectly imperfect versions of ourselves and our partners, and how expectations are often the biggest disappointments. And I think, as you said, those big taboos, sex obviously being one, I'd say money is the other thing that's hardest for couples to talk about. But it's so much of how we measure relationships, at least it feels this way, And maybe it's because it's an objective measure and we know as experts, and I think, you know, most people fundamentally have an idea, at least unconsciously, of this. We look for objective measures of how our relationships are doing. So whether that's that we've moved on to different stages or it's the regularity of sex. And for me, it's such a bad measure of the health of a relationship, but we still cling on to it.
Yeah, the government is obsessed with targets and league tables and, you know, whether school A is better than school B. And, you know, how do you measure it? By putting exams in. And it's like we're forever setting ourselves exams. You can tell when a relationship is really in a dark place is when people are setting each other secret tests. Mm. You know, oh, if he loves me, he will do X, Y, Z, but you haven't actually told him this. And then, of course, he fails because, you know, his mind was on earning enough money to pay the John Lewis bill this week. And he didn't realise that actually the test was not paying the John Lewis bill, but bringing flowers, or whatever it is. So setting yourself tests and judging your relationship on how often you have sex, I think is madness. But then conversely, ignoring it altogether is madness. You know, I sometimes have couples who come to me in complete and utter crisis, normally an affair, and you discover they haven't actually had sex for over 10 years. And you think, what were you thinking about? Why weren't you talking about this stuff?
Yeah.
And there was this sort of sense of, oh, well, we were going to talk about it sometime. It's just, it was too frightening to talk about. So it's back to these contradictions. If you are measuring sex all the time, you know, you're going to ruin it. And if you ignore it completely, you're going to ruin it too. It's that sort of Buddhist idea of the middle way.
And talking about infidelity, something that Esther Perel said, which I have always been really interested in, is in her book, The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity. She said, sometimes when we seek the gaze of another, it isn't our partner we're turning away from, but the person we have become. We're not looking for another lover so much as another version of ourselves. And I think that ties in so well to what you were just saying there, because it's not just that we aren't having the act of sex, it's the meaning that it plays in our relationships. So we might internalize what the lack of sex means. Does it mean I'm undesirable? Does it mean I am aging? Does it mean I've changed? Does it mean I am no longer interesting to other people? Does it mean that I'm no longer attractive? These are just, you know, some really broad and very obvious, you know, probably like slightly crude, but obvious examples. And how what she has written about and talked about a lot is that an affair might make us feel alive again, might make us feel desirable, might make us feel interesting, might make us feel exciting. And that is actually less about our partner, more about the relationship with self.
Yes, I think what she's saying is that instead of actually outsourcing to somebody else the fact that you need this, you know, deep down inside, you know that there is something that needs to change in you. You know, it could be that you've got from one life stage to another. It could be that there are things about yourself that you don't like, that you are sort of bored with yourself almost. It could be you're bored with life. It could be that you've been leading the life that your parents, your first school teacher, or your partner wants you to lead, but actually this is not your life. Now, these are really difficult things. It's frightening to look at yourself and think, you know, what do I want differently? This is a question that I really like. This is from James Hollis, who's a Jungian analyst. And he gets people to ask the question, what is trying to come into the world through you? And I promise you it's not an affair. But it's very easy to think my life is a mess and it's got to be somebody else's fault because, you know, the whole of our society is revolved around pointing the fingers at somebody else. You know, look at the news and there's nobody saying, I think I need to change. It's all you need to change. The government needs to change. The World Health Organization needs to change, et cetera, et cetera. Looking inwards is really difficult. And the repair afterwards is nearly always the person who's had the affair needs to look inside. I'm working with somebody at the moment and, you know, he realized that his life was out of harmony. He was not in harmony with himself. You won't be at all surprised to discover he's a musician. And, you know, why was his life out of harmony? Why was he not listening to himself? What were the ghosts of the past that were knocking him out of harmony?
Yeah.
These were all the things he needed to do. There was a bit of, you know, actually there was some relationship stuff that needed to be done as well, but that's probably about 25% of the work. You know, the majority of it was actually understanding why he was no longer in harmony with himself. And, you know, this has been, it's been going on for a very long time. It stretched all the way back. But I have a book which is called Why Did I Cheat? And it's the question you'll get asked by your partner. And if you're at the beginning of the affair recovery journey, you'll probably answer with all the how of you cheated, which is, you know, how you managed to justify to yourself it was okay, which is, you know, I'm bored and, you know, you don't scratch my back enough sort of kind of stuff, rather than the deeper stuff that I'm looking at. And until you understand the why, and it's nearly always about yourself, you can't heal and your relationship can't heal. I mean, you could go off with your affair partner and start the whole process all over again, because you can't resolve your own stuff by getting somebody else to outsource it, because however much they love you, they can't do the work for you.
Do you think that's the biggest thing that you've learned from being a couples therapist?
What's the biggest thing I've learned from being a couples therapist? I think the biggest thing I've learned is I know absolutely nothing. I mean, every time I go into my room, I end up learning something new. You know, the problem of being an author is because you've got to write, you know, seven steps to recovering from infidelity. You've got to sort of boil it down into big truths. And these are the big truths I tell you. But actually, each of us are different. Each relationship is different. And I'm just forever learning more. So I think that I'd love to give you one single thing, but I really find over and over again, it's I know nothing.
So being comfortable with the uncertainty or the not knowing or the knowing nothing.
Yeah, because actually that is a much more sort of creative place than, you know, here's my treatment program and let's download it and let's use it. I mean, I've got lots of tricks and I've got lots of skills that I can teach, which will help. But, you know, ultimately, my clients have got to find their own way through and I'm helping them. So, you know, the idea of being in harmony works for a musician and it works because that was his image that he came up with. Rather than me giving it to him. So, you know, I don't know what's going to work. I'm thinking of this particular couple, and when they arrived, I thought, oh, you know, I sort of had a little bit of my head in my hands. But they, that together we found a way forward. And that's because I think we stayed with that uncertainty. I think you're right. We don't like uncertainty. We want an answer now, and we want it in, you know, we want a 5-point plan. And sometimes that's actually, that's what's keeping us back. I mean, I was talking to somebody the other day who was having huge problems with depression. And the topic that kept on coming back over and over again is, oh, you know, I'm too impatient to do this and I'm too impatient to do that. It's too frightening to stay in the uncertainty. But you've sort of, you've got to go through the uncertainty. The only way out, or the best way out, is through.
Yeah. So it's like looking for a solution without the process.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the same with sex. We want, because sex is so frightening and so naked and vulnerable, we basically, we want to get our clothes on and out of there as quickly as possible. We've got to stay with that uncertainty and that, you know, and that if you stick with it and you get through the uncertainty and the embarrassment of the messy bits, you can either find great joy in the messy bits, or you can find your way to the joy.
I think there's something really interesting about that. And also this idea that I've been exploring a bit is how kind of introducing sex, or introducing physical touch, or introducing sexual experiences or sensual experiences is a bit like learning a skill as a couple, or, you know, a coupling skill, or learning something new together. Because a lot of what we do as psychosexual therapists is help people to move back towards those physically close experiences. It might be that there's a huge gap because of sexual pain, or because of sexual dysfunction, or because of infertility or miscarriage or mental health, medication, cancer. I mean, the list goes on. But a large part of my job, I consider, is closing the gap. And there is just something in this which can feel a bit unemotional and a bit logical and a bit sensible, but is this idea of we have to exercise or practice closing the gap, and actually then coupling in this way or being intimate in this way can become a skill that we can learn.
I don't understand what you mean by closing the gap. Can you hold the light up to me on that topic?
In terms of, if the gap is, let's use an example which is obvious, which is the gap is we haven't had sex for 2 years.
Right.
And the gap has then not just become about sex, but become about touch, and become about approaching each other. And then that has meant that there is no touch or no kissing or no hugging, because the couple remove, or one partner removes, anything that could lead to sex or any potential opportunities that could lead to sex, because sex has become something negative, something scary, something painful. And so what they then create the gap is, if sex is at the epicenter, we remove any roads to sex, essentially. And that tends to be actually a trigger that I find brings people to therapy, perhaps more than the lack of sex itself. It's the, we never hug anymore, we never kiss anymore, if I touch my partner they pull away, we have no physical contact, approaches, desire.
I would really love to expand the definition of sex, because sex is sort of beginning to become about masturbation, about oral sex, about intercourse, whereas there could be a huge number of things that are sensual and sexual, which doesn't involve any of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you define sex just as those things, you are effectively downgrading things that are just absolutely wonderful. Like, you know, lying in bed on a Saturday morning and just sort of stroking each other and cuddling and teasing each other and tickling each other, and that sort of kind of stuff, which can easily be downgraded to something that isn't sex and therefore isn't counted. But, you know, if your partner was, I always say, if your partner was doing it with somebody else, you'd most definitely think it was sex.
A play-focused model.
Yeah, yeah. That, well, I think much more a sensual thing, so that, you know, foot worship or spanking is just as much sex as intercourse.
Because it's an exploration together or a sensual experience together. I mean, we can obviously have sexual experiences on our own, of course, but...
And if this is actually what turns you on and is, you know, that and is a way that you become vulnerable and open up, then that is absolutely glorious. You're really showing something about yourself.
And I completely agree with you. I mean, I think the current definition of sex is very limiting and very failure success driven, which in itself causes so many problems for so many people. And it's one of the key things that I address with every single person that I work with is, how do we define sex? How do you think about sex? What is included in that definition, and why are the other things not included? You know, I want to know why it's so limiting. And quite often people just go, just is, isn't it? And I say, but is it? So what we're saying is that then if sex is penis and vagina penetration, how do gay couples have sex? How do lesbians have sex? How does someone with a spinal cord injury have a sexual relationship with their partner? What about someone who's had prostate cancer surgery? You know, it's so limiting. And when you start breaking that down, everyone's like, what about if people don't enjoy penetrative sex, but oral sex really works for them, so they've never had sex?
And I mean, I think this is something that if you can open people's minds, you're going to change the other huge problem that people come to me with, which is just complete and utter boredom, because they've actually been doing the same thing that neither of them object to for 20 years. And, you know, no wonder you're bored. You know, 20 years ago when you first got together, do you wear the same clothes? Do you go to the same holiday destinations? Do you go to the same restaurants? No, you talk about these things. And if you say, well, actually, I don't fancy going to Spain this year, the other person doesn't say, oh, my God, you don't love me anymore. But yet the minute you say, I'd like to do something different in the bedroom, your partner thinks either you're having an affair, you don't love them anymore, or there's some kind of catastrophe. I mean, we need to open up these conversations. We talk about everything else. Why can't we talk about how our sexual desire has changed? Because you know, I'm not the same I'm 62. I can assure you I'm not the same person I was when I was 40, and I'm definitely not the same person I was when I was 20. And what I enjoy has changed. You know, I don't go to the same sort of clubs that I used to go to. So why should I have the same sort of sex? But that's what people expect.
So when it comes to our sex lives, we naturally assume, or almost instantly assume, change equals bad.
Yes. Whereas it could be exciting, magical, challenging, and delicious.
So is the biggest problem our perspective?
I think I'm sorry, I think we're coming back to the same old thing. It's fear, you know, that if I want you to play with my feet, I'm a pervert sort of kind of thing. Whereas it could just be that I have, you know, deliciously sensitive feet. It's rather sad. And, you know, planning requires talking. So let's stay with feet, you know, let's do a foot washing ceremony. Well, immediately we need to have a bucket of water and something, you know, and some soap and some oils. And, you know, this takes planning and talking about. And if you can't talk about it, you can't just suddenly spontaneously have all of these things waiting there.
We can't be ready. And It's really, I mean, I would think anyone who has listened to any of the other episodes of my podcast would be like, yes, we all know communication is super important. You bang on about it all the time. But it is just so critical, isn't it? And I think it's the essential pillar of so, I mean, if not everything in life.
There's that expectation, and this is one that I want to scream when I hear it. If she or he really loves me, they'll know what I want.
I knew you were going to say that. I mean, yeah. I mean, we all do it, though. It's great. I don't know why, but I don't know why we all do it.
Because we want this magical person to come along and do all the work for us, you know, that they're somehow going to know. You know, that's the deliciousness, I suppose, of the affair, that somehow they might be the person that knows that I want a bucket of water and soap and oils and a towel waiting beside the bed without me having to say anything. Mm. And it would just be much easier if we could know for ourselves and we could actually communicate that. But, you know, we live in a society that says, you know, to actually ask for what you want often is seen as greedy or selfish.
And you know, we expect our partners to be mind readers.
Yeah, because this is something that we can't actually give ourselves permission to find out what it is we want.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is frightening. You know, what if I discover I like something that my partner doesn't like?
And how will they see me?
You know, it is terrifying. But actually, not saying anything and actually going on with the same old grind is pretty terrifying too.
Yeah. That's often where we work with couples, isn't it? You know, that stuckness. And I suppose, I mean, maybe this is, I think, the big question that everyone's going to want to know. And I imagine the question that lots of people listening to this episode are waiting for. And I think probably the best point to then finish the conversation on. But why does sex change in relationships?
Because we change.
Mm-hmm.
It's as simple as that. You are not the same person you were 10 years ago, are you, Kate? Your life has completely and utterly changed over the last 10 years.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
So why, if you're getting very by, and I'm sure your husband has changed over the last 10 years as well.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So by nature, your relationship is going to change. Mm-hmm. So, and the whole world is changing. That's the one thing that we can guarantee is change. So why should we expect sex not to stay the same? It's sort of weird, really, isn't it?
And it's so, I'm so pleased you've just broken it down into that, because it's, for me, then it leaves me thinking, why do we expect it to stay the same?
Because we are all, every movie that ever was created about relationships is all about the coming together, the magical moment of coming together, the foundation. And because it's entertaining, it's interesting, it's dramatic, etc., etc. There's very few that are actually really about the day-to-day stuff, how we change over time, because you can't show that really very easily in a 1.5-hour movie. Mm. So we're sort of fed this idea that if you choose well, you find the right person, that you live happily ever after. And we don't need to see the next 25, 30, 40 years of the movie, because it's all finished. Mm. We've had that magic moment, that magic coming together where the passion carries us over you know, the sexual attraction and the desire to go and to blend and become a couple is so strong, it pushes aside all of our fears. You know, our animal instincts have taken over, and limerence, the bonding chemicals, are all at their height. And all of the obstacles have been taken away. And so we want to trap that magical moment forever. But actually, there is just as much wonder in that sort of being able to sort of reach out to your partner in bed and just sort of touch them and know they're there, sort of kind of thing. That, you know, it's not so technicolor, all the fireworks going off, but that sort of deep sense of being sure of you is also absolutely wonderful and magical. Mm. And I've just given two examples of love, and we could have two examples of sex. You can have that tear each other's clothes off passion, and you can have that reassuring, I'm here for you and you're here for me, solidity, surety, sex, comfort, comforting, and the stroking and the holding sex.
Mm. And there's something in that, isn't there, that it can be a range of things. It can offer so many things. And, you know, at least personally, I would argue that through difficult times, through some of the worst times, some of the biggest struggles, is where my relationship at least has grown in the, quite frankly, shitness of life that we didn't expect we were going to have to deal with, are the bits where we've been like, wow, okay, we've got through this together and we're out the other side. And there's nothing really romantic or sexual or exciting about battling, you know, for our, in our instance, infertility. And so for me, I think there's something about how we glamorize all the good bits of relationships, but we don't actually credit the working through stuff that lots of couples can do. And whatever that looks like, and it might just be the daily grind, it might be parenting, it doesn't have to be going through something really difficult or challenging, but we don't celebrate those bits.
Yeah, there are moments to lift up. And, you know, I think this would be one thing I would actually encourage people to do, is to notice the little moments of magic. So celebrate the small moments. When you see the sun coming through the window and it sort of strikes your partner and you sort of think, my gosh, he, she is really rather beautiful. You know, that moment when you're on the train and you're thinking, oh, I can't wait to get back home and to have a nice big hug. You know, those moments, little moments of connection, we sort of keep them to ourselves. We don't say them. Mm. So, you know, my advice is say those moments out loud, you know, that when you feel that moment of woohoo, communicate it to your partner. You know, I was just this moment thinking about how beautiful you look when you get out of the bath. You know, so you do those little things that I would call simmer the relationship along. And you don't create them, they're there already. It's just that you spend half your life switching yourself off and ignoring them because, you know, you can't actually have a moment of tenderness at work because you've got to get all these things done. So you switch yourself off. Mm. So, you know, be aware of those emotional and connected sexual moments and communicate them to your partner. If you're there with them, tell them, you know, go and have that hug, interrupt them for 2 minutes and say, you know, I'm really appreciating you at this moment, or I really need a hug. By the way, a hug has to last at least 30 seconds in my world for it to actually count. I don't want any of this in, out, clasp and go. you communicate these things, you simmer. And then when you do finally come to the bedroom or wherever it is you're going to have sex, you're not actually starting from zero, that you've actually been simmering the relationship all along.
It's not a cold start.
Yeah, and who wants to get the jump leads out?
That is such a good point to close the conversation on. And I don't think I have anything else to say. I was just like, there's just something really actionable that I like about that as an ending for this episode as well, which is the little things, which is tell your partner, which is share the little things. Don't just keep them to yourself. Because I think when we talk about the changes we want to make in our relationships, when we think, how do I change this? And you know, there's a million articles and magazines about how to improve relationships or how to make relationships last. But that for me is something really small we shouldn't feel intimidated by.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that I'm really enjoying about my my podcast, The Meaningful Life, is that, you know, I talk each week to somebody and I'm forever given these little things that actually build up and make a big difference. Because, you know, the whole idea of, you know, how do we change our sex life? I'm just completely utterly overwhelmed at the thought of it. But if we break it down and we come up with some things that we can do differently, then we're off on the journey together, aren't we?
Mm. Yeah, we really are. And your podcast is called The Meaningful Life. And tell people where they could find it, please.
Yep, it's called The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. You can find it on my website, www.andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts from. You can follow me on Twitter, and I'm on Facebook as well, both with Andrew G. Marshall. The website, of course, is www.andrewgmarshall.com. Oh, and I think I've got a YouTube channel as well. I'm multimedia these days, even though I don't understand how any of them work.
And I'm a huge advocate for your writing, and anyone who is interested in Andrew's work, there are 20 books to choose from. I mean, just let that sink in, 20.
Oh, perhaps just the one to perhaps mention would be Have the Sex You Want, The Couple's Guide to Getting Back the Spark.
Perfect. Andrew, well, thank you so much for your time, for sharing your wisdom with me. I have loved that conversation. And one thing that never ceases to amaze me, I think, with the work that we do, is so often everything feels so complex, but there is such simplicity in the solutions. And I think this whole conversation's really highlighted that.
But at the same time, what do we know about anything?
It is very true.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Sexual Wellness Sessions. If you'd like to join us for more conversations, you can click subscribe on either Apple or Spotify podcasts. And if you have a moment, please leave us a review.